You'll be drinking soon enough and welcome. But Cy Lucas' drinking days were over. We never know, do we? He went back, and I surveyed them. Luca was the oldest by far. Most of the others were middle-aged, and a couple were still young. They looked interested and excited rather than afraid, and I could understand that. They'd had a couple of drinks to perk them up, and this made a change in the drudgery of their ordinary days. None of them looked shifty or guilty. None looked like anything more or less than what they were, salties in a dying mining town where the rails ended. "Jamie," I said, "a word with you." I walked him to the door and spoke directly into his ear. I gave him an errand and told him to do it as fast as ever he could. He nodded and slipped out into the stormy afternoon, or perhaps by then it was early evening. "Where's he off to?" Wegg asked. "That's Nonny's to you," I said, and turned to the men with the blue tattoos on their ankles. "Line up, if you please, oldest to youngest." "I don't know how old I am, do I?" said a balding man wearing a wrist clock with a rusty string-mended band. Some of the others laughed and nodded. "Just do the best you can," I said. I had no interest in their ages, but the discussion and argument took up some time, which was the main object. If the blacksmith had fulfilled his commission, all would be well. If not, I would improvise. A gunslinger who can't do that dies early. The miners shuffled around like kids playing when the music stops, swapping spots until they were in some rough approximation of age. The line started at the door to the jail and ended at the door to the street. Luca was first. Wrist clock was in the middle. The one who looked about my age, the one who'd said they were always afraid, was last. "Sheriff, will you get their names?" I asked. "I want to speak to the Streeter boy." Billy was standing at the bars of the drunken disorderly cell. He'd heard our palaver and looked frightened. "Is he here?" he asked. "The skin man?" "I think so," I said, "but there's no way to be sure."
"Cy, I'm a scared."
"I don't blame you, but the cell's locked and the bars are good steel. He can't get at you, Billy."
"You ain't seen him when he's a bear," Billy whispered.
His eyes were huge and shiny, fixed in place. I've seen men with eyes like that after they've been punched hard on the jaw. It's the look that comes over them just before their knees go soft. Outside, the wind gave a thin shriek along the underside of the jail roof. "Tim Stoutheart was afraid, too," I said. "But he went on. I expect you to do the same."
"Will you be here?"
"I, my mate Jamie, too." As if I had summoned him, the door to the office opened, and Jamie hurried in, slapping alkali dust from his shirt. The sight of him gladdened me. The smell of dirty feet that accompanied him was less welcome. "Did you get it?" I asked. "Yes, it's a pretty enough thing, and here's the list of names." He handed both over. "Are you ready, son?" Jamie asked Billy.
"I guess so," Billy said. "I'm going to pretend I'm Tim Stoutheart."
Jamie nodded gravely. "That's a fine idea. May you do well." A particularly strong gust of wind blew past. Bitter dust puffed in through the barred window of the drunken disorderly cell. Again came that eerie shriek along the eaves. The light was fading, fading. It crossed my mind that it might be better, safer, to jail the waiting salties and leave this part for tomorrow. But nine of them had done nothing. Neither had the boy. Best to have it done, if it could be done, that was. "Hear me, Billy," I said. "I'm going to walk them through nice and slow. Maybe nothing will happen."
All right."
His voice was faint. "Do you need a drink of water first, or to have a piss?"
"I'm fine," he said, but of course he didn't look fine. He looked terrified. "Cy, how many of them have blue rings on their ankles?"
"All," I said.
"Then how?"
"They don't know how much you saw. Just look at each one as he passes, and stand back a little, do you?" Out of reaching distance was what I meant, but I didn't want to say it out loud.
"What should I say?"
"Nothing. Unless you see something that sets off a recollection, that is." I had little hope of that. "Bring them in, Jamie. Sheriff Peavy at the head of the line, and Wegg at the end." He nodded and left.
Billy reached through the bars. For a second, I didn't know what he wanted. Then I did. I gave his hand a brief squeeze. "Stand back now, Billy, and remember the face of your father. He watches you from the clearing." He obeyed. I glanced at the list, running over names, probably misspelled, that meant nothing to me, with my hand on the butt of my right-hand gun. That one now contained a very special load. According to Vanney, there was only one sure way to kill a skin man, with a piercing object of the holy metal. I had paid the blacksmith in gold, but the bullet he'd made me, the one that would roll under the hammer at first cock, was pure silver. Perhaps it would work. If not, I would follow with lead. The door opened. In came Sheriff Peavy. He had a 2-foot ironwood head knocker in his right hand, the rawhide drop cord looped around his wrist. He was patting the business end gently against his left palm as he stepped through the door. His eyes found the white-faced lad in the cell and he smiled.
"Hey up, Billy, son of Bill," he said. "We're with ye, and all's fine. Fear nothing."
Billy tried to smile, but looked like he feared much. Steg Luka came next, rocking from side to side on those tree-stump feet of his. After him came a man nearly as old, with a mangy white mustache, dirty gray hair falling to his shoulders, and a sinister, squinted look in his eyes. Or perhaps he was only nearsighted. The list named him as Bobby Frayne. "Come slow," I said, "and give this boy a good look at you." They came. As each one passed, Billy Streeter looked anxiously into his face.
"Good evening to you, boy," Luka said as he went by.
Bobby Frayne tipped an invisible cap. One of the younger ones, Jake Marsh, according to the list, stuck out a tongue yellow with bingo weed tobacco. The others just shuffled past. A couple kept their heads lowered until Wegg barked at them to raise up and look the kiddo in the eye. There was no dawning recognition on Bill Streeter's face, only a mixture of fright and perplexity. I kept my own face blank, but I was losing hope. Why, after all, would the skin man break? He had nothing to lose by playing out his string, and he must know it. Now there were only 4 left, then 2, then only the kid who in the busted luck had spoken of being afraid. I saw a change on Billy's face as that one went by, and for a moment I thought we had something, then realized it was nothing more than the recognition of one young person for another. Last came Wegg, who had put away his head knocker and donned brass knuckle dusters on each hand. He gave Billy Streeter a not very pleasant smile.
"Don't see no merchandise you want to buy, Yunker? Well, I'm sorry, but I can't say I'm surprised."
"Gunslinger," Billy said to me. "Side this chain." "Yes, Billy." I shouldered Wegg aside and stood in front of the cell. Billy touched his tongue to his upper lip. "Walk them by again, if it please you. Only this time, have them hold up their pants. I can't see the rings."
"Billy, the rings are all the same."
"No," he said. "They ain't."
The wind was in a lull, and Sheriff Peavy heard him.
"Turn around, my cullies, and back your march. Only this time, hike up your trousers."
"Ain't enough enough,"
the man with the old wrist clock grumbled. The list called him Ollie Yang.
"We was promised shots. Long ones." "What's it to you, honey?" Wegg asked. "Ain't you got to go back that way any row? Did your marmer drop you on your head?"
They grumbled about it, but started back down the corridor toward the office, this time from youngest to oldest, and holding up their pants. All the tattoos looked about the same to me. I at first thought they must to the boy as well. Then I saw his eyes widen, and he took another step away from the bars. Yet he said nothing.
"Sheriff, hold them right there for a moment, if you will," I said.
Peavy moved in front of the door to the office, and I stepped to the cell and spoke low.
"Billy, see something?"
"The mark," he said. "I seen the mark. It's the man with the broken ring."
I didn't understand. Then I did. I thought of all the times Court had called me a Slowkins from the eyebrows up. He called the others those things and worse. Of course he did. It was his job. But standing in the corridor of that Debaria jail with the simoom blowing outside, I thought he had been right about me. I was a Slowkins. Only minutes ago, I'd thought that if there had been more than the memory of the tattoo, I'd have gotten it from Billy when he was hypnotized. Now I realized I had gotten it. "Is there anything else?" I'd asked him, already sure that there wasn't, only wanting to raise him from the trance that was so obviously upsetting him. And when he'd said, "The white mark," but dubiously, as if asking himself, foolish Roland had let it pass. The Salties were getting restless. Ollie Yang, the one with the rusty wrist clock, was saying they'd done as asked, and he wanted to go back to the Busted to get his drink and his damn boots. "Which one?" I asked Billy. He leaned forward and whispered. I nodded, then turned to the knot of men at the end of the corridor. Jamie was watching them closely, hands resting on the butts of his revolvers. The men must have seen something in my face because they ceased their grumbling and just stared. The only sound was the wind and the constant gritty slosh of dust against the building. As to what happened next, I thought it over many times since, and I don't think we could have prevented it. We didn't know how fast the change happened, you see. I don't think Vanney did either, or he would have warned us. Even my father said as much when I finished making my report and stood, with all those books frowning down upon me, waiting for him to pass judgment on my actions in Debaria, not as my father, but as my Din. For one thing, I was and am grateful. I almost told Peavy to bring forward the man Billy had named, but then I changed my mind. Not because Peavy had helped my father once upon a bye, but because little Debaria and the salt houses were not his fill. "Wegg," I said. "Ollie Yang to me, do it please ya."
"Which?"
"The one with the clock on his wrist."
"Here now,"
Ollie Yang squawked as Constable Wegg laid hold of him. He was slight for a minor, almost bookish, but his arms were slabbed with muscle, and I could see more muscle lifting the shoulders of his chambray work shirt.
"Here now, I ain't done nothing. It ain't fair to single me out just because this here kid wants to show off."
"Shut your hole," Wegg said, and pulled him through the little clod of miners. "Huck up your pants again," I told him.
"Fuck you, brat, and the horse you rode in on.
Huck up, or I'll do it for you." He raised his hands and balled them into fists.
"Try, just you
Jamie strolled up behind him, drew one of his guns, tossed it lightly into the air, caught it by the barrel, and brought the butt down on Aang's head. A smartly calculated blow. It didn't knock the man out, but he dropped his fists, and Wegg caught him under the armpit when his knees loosened. I pulled up the right leg of his overalls, and there it was, a blue Billy Stockade tattoo that had been cut, broken, to use Billy Streeter's word, by a thick white scar that ran all the way to his knee. That's what I saw when I was a-laying under that pile of tack.
"He's making it up," Aang said.
He looked dazed, and his words were muzzy. A thin rill of blood ran down the side of his face from where Jamie's blow had opened his scalp a little. I knew better. Billy had mentioned the white mark long before he'd set eyes on Ollie Yang in the jail. I opened my mouth, meaning to tell Wegg to throw him in a cell, but that was when the old man of the crew burst forward. In his eyes was a look of belated realization, nor was that all. He was furious. Before I or Jamie or Wegg could stop him, Steg Luka grabbed Aang by the shoulders and bore him back against the bars across the aisle from the drunken disorderly cell.
"I should have known," he shouted. "I should have known weeks ago, you great grouch, shifty asshole, you murdering trollic!"
He seized the arm bearing the old watch.
"Where'd you get this? If not in the crack, the green light comes from. Where else? Oh, you murdering, skin-changing bastard!"
Lucas spit into Aang's dazed face, then turned to Jamie and me, still holding up the miner's arm.
"Said he found it in a hole outside one of the old foothill plugs. Said it was probably leftover outlaw booty from the Crow Gang, and like fools, we believed him. Even went digging around for more on our days off, didn't we?"
He turned back to the dazed Ollie Yang. Dazed was how he looked to us, anyway. But who knows what was going on behind those eyes.
"And you laughing up your fucking sleeve at us while we did it, I've no doubt. You found it in a hole, all right, but it wasn't in one of the old plugs. You went into the crack, into the green light. It was you. It was you. It was...
Aang twisted from the chin up. I don't mean he grimaced. His entire head twisted. It was like watching a cloth being wrung by invisible hands. His eyes rose up until one was above the other, and they turned from blue to jet black. His skin paled first to white, then to green. It rose as if pushed by fists from beneath and cracked into scales. His clothes dropped from his body because his body was no longer that of a man, nor was it a bear or a wolf or a lion. Those things we might have been prepared for. We might even have been prepared for an alligator, such as the thing that had assaulted the unfortunate Fortuna at Serenity, although it was closer to an alligator than anything else. In a space of 3 seconds, Ollie Aang turned into a man-high snake, a pookie. Luca, still holding onto an arm that was shrinking toward that fat green body, gave out a yell that was muffled when the snake, still with a flopping tonsure of human hair around its elongating head, jammed itself into the old man's mouth. There was a wet popping sound as Luca's lower jaw was torn from the joints and tendons, holding it to the upper. I saw his wattled neck swell and grow smooth as that thing, still changing, still standing on the dwindling remnants of human legs, bored into his throat like a drill. There were yells and screams of horror from the head of the aisle as the other salty stampeded. I paid them no notice. I saw Jamie wrap his arms around the snake's growing, swelling body in a fruitless attempt to pull it out of the dying Steg Luca's throat, and I saw the enormous reptilian head when it tore its way through the nape of Luca's neck, its red tongue flicking, its scaly head painted with beads of blood and bits of flesh. Wegg threw one of his brass-knuckle-decorated fists at it. The snake dodged easily, then struck forward, exposing enormous, still-growing fangs, two on top, two on bottom, all dripping with clear liquid. It battened on Wegg's arm, and he shrieked,
"Burns! Dear gods, it burns!"
Luca, impaled at the head, seemed to dance as the snake dug its fangs into the struggling constable. Blood and gobbets of flesh spattered everywhere. Jamie looked at me wildly. His guns were drawn, but where to shoot? The pookie was writhing between two dying men. Its lower body, now legless, flipped free of the heaped clothes, wound itself around Luca's waist in fat coils, drew tight. The part behind the head was slithering out through the widening hole at the nape of Luca's neck. I stepped forward, seized Wegg, and dragged him backward by the scruff of his vest. His bitten arm had already turned black and swelled to twice its normal size. His eyes were bulging from their sockets as he stared at me, and white foam began to drizzle from his lips. Somewhere, Billy Streeter was screaming. The fangs tore free.
"Burns,"
Wegg said in a low voice, and then he could say no more. His throat swelled, and his tongue shot out of his mouth. He collapsed, shuddering in his death throes. The snake stared at me, its forked tongue licking in and out. They were black snake eyes, but they were filled with human understanding. I lifted the revolver holding the special load. I had only one silver shell, and the head was weaving erratically from side to side, but I never doubted I could make the shot. It's what such as I was made for. It lunged, fangs flashing, and I pulled the trigger. The shot was true, and the silver bullet went right into that yawning mouth. The head blew away in a splatter of red that had begun to turn white even before it hit the bars and the floor of the corridor. I'd seen such mealy white flesh before. It was brains. Human brains. Suddenly, it was Ollie Aang's ruined face peering at me from the ragged hole in the back of Luca's neck, peering from atop a snake's body. Shaggy black fur sprang from between the scales on its body as whatever force dying inside lost all control of the shapes it made. In the moment before it collapsed, the remaining blue eye turned yellow and became a wolf's eye. Then it went down, bearing the unfortunate Steg Luca with it. In the corridor, the dying body of the skin man shimmered and burned, wavered and changed. I heard the pop of muscles and the grind of shifting bones. A naked foot shot out, turned into a furry paw, then became a man's foot again. The remains of Ollie Aang shuddered all over, then grew still. The boy was still screaming. "Go to yon pallet and lie down," I said to him. My voice was not quite steady. "Close your eyes and tell yourself it's over, for now it is."
"I want you,"
Billy sobbed as he went to the pallet. His cheeks were speckled with blood. I was drenched with it, but this he didn't see. His eyes were already closed.
"I want you with me. Please, Sai. Please."
"I'll come to you as soon as I can," I said. And I did. Three of us spent the night on pushed-together pallets in the drunken disorderly cell. Jamie on the left, me on the right, young Bill Streeter in the middle. The Samoom had begun to die, and until late we heard the sound of revels on the high street as Dabaria celebrated the death of the Skin Man. "What will happen to me, Sai?" Billy asked just before he finally fell asleep. "Good things," I said, and hoped Everlyn of Serenity would not prove me wrong about that.
"Is it dead? Really dead, Sai Deschain?"
"Really." But on that score, I meant to take no chance. After midnight, when the wind was down to a bare breeze and Bill Streeter lay in an exhausted sleep so deep even bad dreams couldn't reach him, Jamie and I joined Sheriff Peavy on the waste ground behind the jail. There, we doused the body of Ollie Aang with coal oil. Before setting match to it, I asked if either of them wanted the wrist clock as a souvenir. Somehow it hadn't been broken in the struggle, and the cunning little second hand still turned. Jamie shook his head.
"Nor I," said Peavy, "for it might be haunted. Go on, Roland, if I may call ye so."
"And welcome," I said. I struck the sulfur and dropped it. We stood watching until the remains of Dabaria's Skin Man were nothing but black bones. The wrist clock was just a charred lump in the ash. The following morning, Jamie and I rounded up a crew of men, more than willing they were, to go out to the rail line. Once they were there, it was a matter of 2 hours to put Smawtoot back on the double steel. Travis, the NG, directed the operation, and I made many friends by telling them I'd arranged for everyone in the crew to eat free at Racy's at top of day and drink free at the Busted Luck that afternoon. There was to be a town celebration that night at which Jamie and I would be guests of honor. It was the sort of thing I could happily do without. I was anxious to get home, and as a rule, company doesn't suit me. But such events are often part of the job. One good thing, there would be women, some of them no doubt pretty. That part I wouldn't mind, and suspected Jamie wouldn't either. He had much to learn about women, and Dabaria was as good a place to begin his studies as any. He and I watched Smawtoot puff slowly up to the roundway and then make its way toward us again, pointed in the right direction, toward Gilead. "Will we stop at Serenity on the way back to town?" Jamie asked, to ask if they'll take the boy in. "Aye, and the prioress said she had something for me. Do you know what?" I shook my head. Everlyn, that mountain of a woman, swept toward us across the courtyard of Serenity, her arms spread wide. I was almost tempted to run. It was like standing in the path of one of the vast trucks that used to run at the oil fields near Cuna. Instead of running us down, she swept us into a vast and bosomy double hug. Her aroma was sweet, a mixture of cinnamon and thyme and baked goods. She kissed Jamie on the cheek. He blushed. Then she kissed me full on the lips. For a moment, we were enveloped by her complicated and billowing garments and shaded by her winged silk hood. Then she drew back, her face shining. "What a service you have done this town, and how we say thank you!" I smiled. "Sai Everlyn, you were too kind." "Not kind enough. You'll have Noonies with us, yes? And meadow wine, although only a little. You'll have more to drink tonight, I have no doubt." She gave Jamie a roguish side glance. "But you'll want to be careful when the toasts go around. Too much drink can make a man less a man later on and blur memories he might otherwise want to keep." She paused, then broke into a knowing grin that went oddly with her robes. Or perhaps not. Jamie blushed harder than ever, but said nothing.
We saw you coming, Evelyn said, and there's someone else who'd like to give you her thanks.
She moved aside, and there stood the tiny sister of Serenity named Fortuna. She was still swathed in bandagement, but she looked less wraith-like today, and the side of the face we could see was shining with happiness and relief. She stepped forward, shyly.
I can sleep again, and in time I may even be able to sleep without nightmares.
She twitched up the side of her gray robe and, to my deep discomfort, fell on her knees before us.
Sister Fortuna, Annie Clay that was, says thank you. So do we all, but this comes from my own heart.
I took her gently by the shoulders. Rise, bondswoman, kneel not before such as us. She looked at me with shining eyes and kissed me on the cheek with the side of her mouth that could still kiss. Then she fled back across the courtyard toward what I assumed was their kitchen. Wonderful smells were already arising from that part of the Hasi. Evelyn watched her go with a fond smile, then turned back to me.
There's a boy, I began.
She nodded. Bill Streeter. I know his name and his story. We don't go to town, but sometimes the town comes to us. Friendly birds twitter news in our ears, if you take my meaning.
I take it well, I said.
Bring him tomorrow, after your heads have shrunk back to their normal size, said she. We're a company of women, but we're happy to take an orphan boy, at least until he grows enough hair on his upper lip to shave. After that, women trouble a boy, and it might not be so well for him to stay here. In the meantime, we can set him about his letters and numbers, if he's trig enough to learn, that is. Would you say he's trig enough, Roland, son of Gabrielle? It was odd to be called from my mother's side rather than my father's, but strangely pleasant.
I'd say he's very trig.
That's well, then, and we'll find a place for him when it's time for him to go.
A plot and a place, I said.
Evelyn laughed. Aye, just so, like in the story of Tim Stoutheart. And now we'll break bread together, shall we? And with meadow wine we'll toast the prowess of young men. We ate, we drank, and all in all, it was a very merry meeting. When the sisters began to clear the trestle tables, Prioress Evelyn took me to her private quarters, which consisted of a bedroom and a much larger office where a cat slept in a bar of sun on a huge oaken desk heaped high with papers.
Few men have been here, Roland, she said. One was a fellow you might know. He had a white face and black clothes. Do you know the man of whom I speak?
Martin Broadcloak, I said. The good food in my stomach was suddenly sour with hate, and jealousy, I suppose, nor just on behalf of my father, whom Gabrielle of Arton had decorated with cuckold's horns.
Did he see her?
He demanded to, but I refused and sent him hence. At first he declined to go, but I showed him my knife and told him there were other weapons in Serenity.
Aye, and women who know how to use them. One, I said, was a gun. I reminded him that he was deep inside the Hasi, and suggested that, unless he could fly, he had better take heed.
He did, but before he went, he cursed me, and he cursed this place.
She hesitated, stroked the cat, then looked up at me.
There was a time when I thought perhaps the Skin Man was his work.
I don't think so, I said.
Nor I. But neither of us will ever be entirely sure, will we?
The cat tried to climb into the vast playground of her lap, and Evelyn shooed it away.
Of one thing I am sure. He spoke to her anyway, although whether through the window of her cell late at night, or only in her troubled dreams, no one will ever know. That secret she took with her into the clearing, poor woman. To this I did not reply. When one is amazed and heartsick, it's usually best to say nothing, for in that state, any word will be the wrong word.
Your lady mother quit her retirement with us shortly after we turned this Broadcloak fellow around. She said she had a duty to perform, and much to atone for. She said her son would come here. I asked her how she knew, and she said, "Because Ka is a wheel, and it always turns."
She left this for you.
Evelyn opened one of the many drawers of her desk and removed an envelope. Written on the front was my name in a hand I knew well. Only my father would have known it better. That hand had once turned the pages of a fine old book as she read me The Wind Through the Keyhole, I and many others. I loved all the stories held in the pages that hand turned, but never so much as I loved the hand itself. Even more, I loved the sound of the voice that told them as the wind blew outside. Those were the days before she was mazed and fell into the sad bitchery that brought her under a gun in another hand. My gun. My hand. Evelyn rose, smoothing her large apron. I must go and see how things are advancing in other parts of my little kingdom. I'll bid you goodbye now, Roland, son of Gabriel, only asking that you pull the door shut when you go. It will lock itself. You trust me with your things? I asked. She laughed, came around the desk, and kissed me again. Gunslinger, I'd trust you with my life, said she, and left. She was so tall she had to duck her head when she went through the door. I sat looking at Gabrielle Deschain's last missive for a long time. My heart was full of hate and love and regret, all those things that have haunted me ever since. I considered burning it unread, but at last I tore the envelope open. Inside was a single sheet of paper. The lines were uneven, and the pigeon ink in which they had been written was blotted in many places. I believed that the woman who wrote those lines was struggling to hold on to a few last shreds of sanity. I'm not sure many would have understood her words, but I did. I'm sure my father would have as well, but I never showed it to him or told him of it. The feast I ate was rotten. What I thought was a palace was a dungeon. How it burns, Roland. I thought of Wegg dying of snake bite. If I go back and tell what I know, what I overheard, Gilead may yet be saved a few years. You may be saved a few years. Your father, little that he ever cared for me. The words, little that he ever cared for me, had been crossed out with a series of heavy lines, but I could read them anyway. He says, I dare not. He says, bide at serenity until death finds you. He says, if you go back, death will find you early. He says, your death will destroy the only one in the world for whom you care. He says, would you die at your brat's hand and see every goodness, every kindness, every loving thought poured out of him like water from a dipper? For Gilead that cared for you little and will die anyway? But I must go back. I have prayed on it and meditated on it, and the voice I hear always speaks the same words. This is what Ka demands. There was a little more, words I traced over and over during my wandering years after the disastrous battle at Jericho Hill and the fall of Gilead. I traced them until the paper fell apart and I let the wind take it, the wind that blows through time's keyhole, you can. In the end, the wind takes everything, doesn't it? And why not? Why other? If the sweetness of our lives did not depart, there would be no sweetness at all. I stayed in Evelyn's office until I had myself under control. Then I put my mother's last word, her dead letter, in my purse and left, making sure the door locked behind me. I found Jamie and we rode to town. That night there were lights and music and dancing, many good things to eat and plenty of liquor to wash it down with. There were women, too, and that night Silent Jamie left his virginity behind him. The next morning, Storms over. That night, Roland said, there were lights and music and dancing, many good things to eat and plenty of liquor to wash it down with. Booze, Eddie said, and heaved a seriocomic sigh. I remember it well. It was the first thing any of them had said in a very long time, and it broke the spell that had held them through that long and windy night. They stirred like people awaking from a deep dream, all except Oi, who still lay on his back in front of the fireplace, with his short paws splayed and the tip of his tongue lolling comically from the side of his mouth. Roland nodded. There were women, too, and that night Silent Jamie left his virginity behind him. The next morning, we reboarded Small Toot and made our way back to Gilead, and so it happened, once upon a bye. Long before my grandfather's grandfather was born, Jake said in a low voice. Of that I can't say, Roland said with a slight smile, and then took a long drink of water. His throat was very dry. For a moment, there was silence among them. Then Eddie said, "Thank you, Roland, that was boss." The gunslinger raised an eyebrow. "He means it was wonderful," Jake said. "It was, too." "I see light around the boards we put over the windows," Susanna said. "Just a little, but it's there. You talk down the dark, Roland. I guess you're not the strong, silent Gary Cooper type after all, are you?" "I don't know who that is." She took his hand and gave it a brief, hard squeeze. "Never mind, sugar." "Wind's dropped, but it's still blowing pretty hard," Jake observed. "We'll build up the fire, then sleep," the gunslinger said. "This afternoon it should be warm enough for us to go out and gather more wood. And tomorrow day..." "Back on the road," Eddie finished. "As you say, Eddie." Roland put the last of their fuel on the guttering fire, watched as it sprang up again, then lay down and closed his eyes. Seconds later, he was asleep. Eddie gathered Susanna into his arms, then looked over her shoulder at Jake, who was sitting cross-legged and looking into the fire. "Time to catch 40 winks, little trail hand. Don't call me that. You know I hate it." "Okay, buckaroo." Jake gave him the finger. Eddie smiled and closed his eyes. The boy gathered his blanket around him. "My shaddy," he thought, and smiled. Beyond the walls, the wind still moaned, a voice without a body. Jake thought, "It's on the other side of the keyhole. And over there, where the wind comes from, all of eternity, and the dark tower." He thought of the boy Roland Deschain had been an unknown number of years ago, lying in a circular bedroom at the top of a stone tower, tucked up cozy and listening to his mother read the old tales while the wind blew across the dark land. As he drifted, Jake saw the woman's face and thought it kind as well as beautiful. His own mother had never read him stories. In his plot and place, that had been the housekeeper's job. He closed his eyes and saw Billy Bumblers on their hind legs, dancing in the moonlight. He slept. When Roland woke in the early afternoon, the wind was down to a whisper and the room was much brighter. Eddie and Jake were still deeply asleep, but Susanna had awakened, boosted herself into her wheelchair, and removed the boards blocking one of the windows. Now she sat there with her chin propped on her hand, looking out. Roland went to her and put his own hand on her shoulder. Susanna reached up and patted it without turning around. "Storm's over, sugar." "Yes, let's hope we never see another like it. And if we do, let's hope the shelter is good as this one close by. As for the rest of Gook Village..." She shook her head. Roland bent a little to look out. What he saw didn't surprise him, but it was what Eddie would have called awesome. The high street was still there, but it was full of branches and shattered trees. The buildings that had lined it were gone. Only the stone meeting hall remained. "We were lucky, weren't we?" "Luck's the word those with poor hearts use for Ka, Susanna of New York." She considered this without speaking. The last breezes of the dying Stark blast came through the hole where the window had been and stirred the tight cap of her hair, as if some invisible hand were stroking it. Then she turned to him. "She left Serenity and went back to Gilead, your lady mother." "Yes." even though the son of a bitch told her she'd die at her own son's hand?
I doubt if he put it just that way, but yes.
It's no wonder she was half crazy when she wrote that letter. Roland was silent, looking out the window at the destruction the storm had brought, yet they had found shelter, good shelter from the storm. She took his three-fingered right hand in both of hers. What did she say at the end? What were the words you traced over and over until her letter fell apart? Can you tell me? He didn't answer for a long time. Just when she was sure he wouldn't, he did. In his voice, almost undetectable but most certainly there, was a tremor Susanna had never heard before. She wrote in the low speech until the last line. That she wrote in the high, each character beautifully drawn. I forgive you everything. And can you forgive me? Susanna felt a single tear, warm and perfectly human, run down her cheek. And could you, Roland? Did you? Still looking out the window, Roland of Gilead, son of Stephen and Gabrielle, she of Arden that was, smiled. It broke upon his face like the first glow of sunrise on a rocky landscape. He spoke a single word before going back to his gunna to build them an afternoon breakfast. The word was, yes. They spent one more night in the meeting hall. There was fellowship and palaver, but no stories. The following morning, they gathered their gunna and continued along the path of the beam, to Calibryn Sturgis, and the Borderlands, and Thunderclap, and the Dark Tower beyond. These are things that happen once upon a bye. Afterward. In the high speech, Gabrielle Deschain's final message to her son are only symbols, and yet the two most beautiful words in any language are, I forgive.
Wind Through the Keyhole was written and read by Stephen King. With original music by Luke Dick, lukedick.org. It was recorded by Mike Badalamenti at Audio Images in Bradenton, Florida. Editing, mixing, and post-production by Frog Pond Productions. The associate producer was Louisa Solomon. The Wind Through the Keyhole was produced and directed by Tara Thomas. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. The Wind Through the Keyhole, a Dark Tower novel, is available in hardcover from Scribner. The entire The Dark Tower series is available from Simon & Schuster Audio. Keep listening for a clip from The Dark Tower 7.
'99. Reproduction. Revelation. Redemption. Resumption. Part 1. The Little Red King. Dan Titi. Chapter 1. Callahan and the Vampires. 1. Père Don Callahan had once been the Catholic priest of a town, Salem's Lot had been its name, that no longer existed on any map. He didn't much care. Concepts such as reality had ceased to matter to him. This one-time priest now held a heathen object in his hand, a scrimshaw turtle made of ivory. There was a nick in its beak, and a scratch in the shape of a question mark on its back, but otherwise, it was a beautiful thing. Beautiful and powerful. He could feel the power in his hand, like volts. "How lovely it is," he whispered to the boy who stood with him. "Is it the turtle Maturin? It is, isn't it?" The boy was Jake Chambers, and he'd come a long loop in order to return almost to his starting place here in Manhattan. "I don't know," he said. "She calls it the Sholpada. And it may help us, but it can't kill the harriers that are waiting for us in there." He nodded toward the Dixie Pig, wondering if he meant Susanna or Mia when he used that all-purpose feminine pronoun she. Once he would have said it didn't matter because the two women were so tightly wound together. Now, however, he thought it did matter, or would, soon. "Will you?" Jake asked the pair, meaning, "Will you stand? Will you fight? Will you kill?" "Oh, yes," Callahan said calmly. He put the ivory turtle with its wise eyes and scratched back into his breast pocket with the extra shells for the gun he carried, then patted the cunningly made thing once to make sure it rode safely. "I'll shoot until the bullets are gone, and if I run out of bullets before they kill me, I'll club them with the gun butt." The pause was so slight, Jake didn't even notice it. But in that pause, the white spoke to Father Callahan. It was a force he knew of old, even in boyhood. Although there had been a few years of bad faith along the way, years when his understanding of that elemental force had first grown dim and then become lost completely. But those days were gone. The white was his again, and he told God thank you. Jake was nodding, saying something Callahan barely heard. And what Jake said didn't matter. What that other voice said, the voice of something Gan, perhaps too great to be called God, did. "The boy must go on," the voice told him. "Whatever happens here, however it falls, the boy must go on. Your part in the story is almost done. His is not." They walked past a sign on a chrome post, closed for private function. Jake's special friend Oi trotting between them, his head up and his muzzle wreathed in its usual toothy grin. At the top of the steps, Jake reached into the woven sack Susanna Mio had brought out of Calibrin Sturgis and grabbed two of the plates, the risers. He tapped them together, nodded at the dull ringing sound, and then said, "Let's see yours." Callahan lifted the Ruger Jake had brought out of Cala, New York, and now back into it. "Life is a wheel, and we all say thank you." For a moment the pair held the Ruger's barrel beside his right cheek like a duelist. Then he touched his breast pocket, bulging with shells and with the turtle. The Sholpada. Jake nodded. "Once we're in, we stay together. Always together, with Oi between. On three. And once we start, we never stop." "Never stop." "Right. Are you ready?" "Yes. God's love on you, boy. And on you, pair. One, two, three." Jake opened the door, and together they went into the dim light and the sweet, tangy smell of roasting meat.
This is Stephen King. I hope you've enjoyed this reading of The Wind Through the Keyhole. If you want to stick around a bit, what follows is the first chapter of a new novel, which will be published in 2013. For years I wondered what might have become of Danny Torrance, the little boy who spent a frightening winter in a haunted hotel called The Overlook. Finally, I determined to write a sequel to that novel, which was called The Shining, and find out for myself. The results were frightening, but if you enjoy being scared as much as I do, you might like it. Here is Chapter 1 of Doctor Sleep. Lockbox. On the second day of December, in the year of 1977, one of Colorado's great resort hotels burned to the ground. The Overlook was declared a total loss. After an investigation, the fire marshal of Jicarilla County ruled the cause had been a defective boiler. The hotel was closed for the winter when the accident occurred, and only four people were present. Three survived. The hotel's off-season caretaker, John Torrance, was killed during an unsuccessful and heroic effort to dump the boiler's steam pressure, which had mounted to a disastrously high level due to an inoperative relief valve. Two of the survivors were the caretaker's wife and young son. The third was the Overlook chef, Richard Halloran, who had left his seasonal job in Florida and come to check on the Torrances because of what he called a powerful hunch that the family was in trouble. Both surviving adults had been quite badly injured in the explosion. Only the child was unhurt, physically at least. Wendy Torrance and her son received a settlement from the corporation that owned the Overlook. It wasn't huge, but enough to get them by for the 3 years she was unable to work because of back injuries. A lawyer she consulted told her that if she were willing to hold out and play tough, she would get more, perhaps a great deal more, because the corporation was anxious to avoid a court case. But she, like the corporation, wanted only to put that disastrous winter in Colorado behind her. She would convalesce, she said, and she did, although her back injuries plagued her until the end of her life. Shattered vertebrae may heal, and broken ribs, but they never cease crying out. Winifred and Daniel Torrance lived in Maryland for a while, then drifted down to Tampa. Sometimes Dick Halloran, he of the powerful hunches, came up from Key West to visit them, to visit with young Danny especially. They shared a bond. One early morning in March of 1981, Wendy called Dick and asked if he could come. Danny, she said, had awakened her in the night and told her not to go in the bathroom. After that, he refused to talk at all. He woke up needing to pee. Outside, a strong wind was blowing. It was warm. In Florida, it was almost always warm. But he did not like that sound, and supposed he never would. It reminded him of the Overlook, where the defective boiler had been the very least of the dangers. He and his mother lived in a cramped second-floor tenement apartment. Danny left the little room next to his mother's and crossed the hall. The wind gusted, and a dying palm tree beside the building clattered its leaves. The sound was skeletal. They always left the bathroom door open when no one was using it because the lock was broken. Now it was closed. Not because his mother was in there, however. Thanks to facial injuries she'd suffered at the Overlook, she now snored, a soft queep, queep sound, and he could hear it coming from her bedroom. Well, he thought, she closed it by accident, that's all. He knew better, even then. He was a boy of powerful hunches and intuitions himself. But sometimes you had to know. Sometimes you had to see. This was something he had found out at the Overlook, in a room on the second floor. Reaching with an arm that seemed too long, too stretchy, too boneless, he turned the knob and opened the door. The woman from room 217 was there, as he had known she would be. She was sitting naked on the toilet, with her legs spread and her pallid thighs bulging. Her peeling breasts hung down like deflated balloons. The patch of hair below her stomach was gray. Her eyes were also gray, like steel mirrors. She saw him, and her decayed lips stretched back in a grin. "Close your eyes," Dick Halloran had told him once upon a time. "If you see something bad, close your eyes and tell yourself it's not there, and when you open them again, it will be gone." But it hadn't worked in room 217 when he was 5, and it wouldn't work now. He knew it. He could smell her. She was decaying. The woman, he knew her name, it was Mrs. Massey, lumbered to her purple feet, holding out her hands to him. The flesh on her arms hung down, almost dripping. She was smiling the way you do when you see an old friend, or perhaps something good to eat. With an expression that could have been mistaken for calmness, Danny closed the door softly and stepped back. He watched as the knob turned right, left, right again, then stilled. He was 8 now, and capable of at least some rational thought, even in his horror. Partly because, in some deep part of his mind, he had been expecting this, although he had always thought it would be Horace Derwent who would eventually show up. Or perhaps the bartender, the one his father had called Lloyd. He supposed he should have known it would be Mrs. Massey, though, even before it finally happened. Because of all the undead things in the Overlook, she had been the worst. The rational part of his mind told him she was just a fragment of unremembered bad dream that had followed him out of sleep and across the hall to the bathroom. That part insisted that if he opened the door again, there would be nothing there. Surely there wouldn't be, now that he was awake. But another part of him, a part that shone, knew better. The Overlook wasn't done with him, even yet. At least one of its vengeful spirits had followed him all the way to Florida. Once he had come upon that woman sprawled in a bathtub. She had gotten out and tried to choke him with her fishy but terribly strong fingers. If he opened the bathroom door now, she would finish the job. He compromised by putting his ear against the door. At first there was nothing. Then he heard a faint sound. Dead fingernails scratching on wood. Danny walked into the kitchen on not their legs, stood on a chair, and peed into the sink. Then he woke his mother and told her not to go into the bathroom because there was a bad thing there. Once that was done, he went back to bed and sank deep beneath the covers. He wanted to stay there forever, only getting up to pee in the sink. Now that he had warned his mother, he had no interest in talking to her. His mother knew about the no-talking thing. It had happened before, after Danny had ventured into room 217 at the Overlook. "Will you talk to Dick?" Lying in his bed, looking up at her, he nodded. His mother called, even though it was 4 in the morning. Late the next day, Dick came. He brought something with him. A present. After Wendy called Dick, she made sure Danny heard her doing it. Danny went back to sleep. Although he was now 8 and in the 3rd grade, he was sucking his thumb. It hurt her to see it. She went to the bathroom door and stood looking at it. She was afraid. Danny had made her afraid, but she had to go, and she had no intention of going in the sink. The image of how she would look, teetering on the edge of the counter with her butt hanging over the porcelain, even if there was no one there to see, made her wrinkle her nose. In one hand, she had the hammer from her little box of tools. As she turned the knob and pushed the bathroom door open, she raised it. The bathroom was empty, of course, but the ring of the toilet seat was down. She never left it that way before going to bed, because she knew if Danny wandered in, only 10% awake, he was apt to forget to put it up and piss all over it. Also, there was a smell. A bad one. As if a rat had died in the walls. She took a step in, then 2. She saw movement and whirled, hammer upraised to hit whoever, whatever, was hiding behind the door. But it was only her shadow. Scared of his or her own shadow, people sometimes sneered, but who had a better right than Wendy Torrance? After the things she had seen and been through, she knew that shadows could be dangerous. They could have teeth. No one was in the bathroom, but there was a discolored smear on the toilet seat ring and another on the shower curtain. Excrement was her first thought, but shit wasn't yellowish purple. She looked more closely and saw bits of flesh and decayed skin. More of it was on the bath mat. There it formed the shape of footprints. She thought them too small, too dainty to be a man's. "Oh, God," she whispered. She ended up using the sink, after all. Wendy nagged Danny out of bed at noon. She managed to get a little soup and half a peanut butter sandwich into him, but then he went back to bed. He still wouldn't speak. Halloran arrived shortly after 5 in the afternoon, behind the wheel of his now ancient but perfectly maintained and blindingly polished red Cadillac.